Hi, everyone. Mike Malatesta here, and welcome back to the How'd It Happen podcast. On this podcast, I dig in deep with every guest to explore the roots of their success, to discover not just how it happened, but why it matters. My mission is to find and share stories that inspire, activate, and maximize the greatness in you.
On today's episode, I'm talking to a guy who started his career digging ditches out of high school and became an amazing entrepreneur, a Wall Street Journal best-selling author, and I'll add, a philosopher as well. Ken Rusk and I talk about the power of visualization, how to build a battleship, the mindset behind you and only you, why he never uses the word someday, and his commitment to helping people find and achieve comfort, peace, and freedom in their lives. I guarantee you will enjoy this conversation.
The more you stare at something that you want in your life, crystal clear, colorful, concise, the more these neurotransmitters fire back and forth in your brain to the point where they become one constant thought. Mm-hmm. Once that happens, your brain actually thinks it already owns that thing. So then it sets your body in motion to go get that thing in things like awareness of opportunities, getting out of bed and going getting it, entrepreneurism, initiative, faith, courage, humility. Why not use the power of that and allow your brain to work for you in a way that very few people actually do because they're just waiting to react to something or for someone else to tell them how to live?
This episode is sponsored by The Dream Exit. The Dream Exit is a private, bespoke program for successful entrepreneurs with annual revenue between $5 million and $100 million who realize that they have one chance to get their dream exit right, and that the odds of realizing that dream by themselves, all alone, or at the last minute are stacked against them. In less than 90 days, we teach you how to design, build, and execute a customized dream exit playbook that gets your business ready for sale at its maximum value and gets you ready to maximize your meaning and purpose in your post-exit life, even if today you are not ready to sell. You see, dream exits just don't happen. They are the result of early professional and proven planning. So if you're an entrepreneur with annual sales between 5 and 100 million and you want to learn how to 10x to 100x your chances of achieving the dream exit you deserve, go to dreamexitplaybook.com today.
And here's Ken Rusk. Hello, Ken. Welcome to the How'd It Happen podcast.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
I'm very glad you're here because, well, I loved your book, which is Blue Collar Cash. You can see it here, everybody. And I love your message. Like, I love what that's all about, especially, well, I listen to Mike Rowe a lot, and you remind me of Mike Rowe. Like, he's always talking about this kind of stuff, except I think Mike Rowe did go to college. So I think there's like a difference in background, and you'll learn more about that as we dig more into Ken's story. So let me tell you a little bit about Ken to get you started. Ken Rusk is a best-selling author of Blue Collar Cash, Love Your Work, Secure Your Future, and Find Happiness for Life. He's an entrepreneur and a blue-collar advocate, showing that there's no degree required for comfort, peace, and freedom. He is a blue-collar construction business entrepreneur who has launched multiple successful endeavors over the last 30 years. For the first many of those years, his young working life, he dug ditches for a basement repair company in Northern Ohio. I suppose that was because water was coming into the basements, one of those.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. All right. And over the years, he dug his way to a good life. I love one shovel of dirt at a time. And now he is teaching others to do the same. Ken has extensive experience in hiring, training, and developing first-time job seekers, particularly those without college degrees. He lives in Toledo, Ohio, where he runs Rusk Industries, which specializes in various forms of construction. So, Ken, I start every show with a simple question, and that is, how did it happen for you?
Well, again, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
You know, I suppose that I guess I've been accused of being a blue-collar entrepreneur, and the way that happened was very simple. When I was 15 in my high school property shared a fence with an industrial park, and we used to cut through a hole in the fence to go through the industrial park and go hang out at the carryout at the end of the street after school. And it was interesting because the more that I did that, the more I kind of got in tune with some of these businesses and what they were all about. Lots of energy, lots of people milling about, lots of like grown up Tonka toys, you know, the things you use when you were a kid, but for real in real life. And, you know, it was time. I mean, I had a couple of really part-time jobs before that, but I wanted my first kind of full-time job where I could buy my first new used car. I take my girlfriend out for pizza or go bowling with my buddies, whatever. And so one day I went into one of these businesses and I said, "What do you guys do here?" And they said, "We basically dig ditches." And I knew somebody that had worked there. So I said, "Well, I'm wholly qualified for that." And so, yeah, I started digging ditches with them in the summertime, fixing old wet, smelly basements. And in the wintertime, when I was in school still, I'd go work in the office after school. So it was really convenient for me. And it was a great way to learn both sides of the business, which ended up happening. I ended up learning the production side and the wholesales and marketing side. So when it came time for me to decide, was I going to college or was I going to graduate and go to work? What was I going to do? They approached me and said, "Hey, before we make that decision, we are going to start opening franchises around the Midwest and we want you to do it. We want you to help us do that." So, Mike, I literally lived out of a suitcase going to Chicago and Columbus and Cincinnati and Pittsburgh and, you know, all over the place, setting up these new businesses literally from scratch. I mean, we had to build out the buildings and then we had to put the office furniture in and get the phone equipment and then hire the people, get them started and then move on. And, you know, I did that for four years or so and got tired of living out of a suitcase. And then I ended up moving to where I am now, which is Sylvania, Ohio, just outside of Toledo on the west end of Lake Erie, and started my own company. We opened with six people back in 1986, which is, I guess, 38 years now. And, now I think we have like 200 or 300 and we're involved in some other construction stuff too. So it's been a heck of a ride.
And Ken, was there anything else that went into your selection of going to the basement repair company, except that you knew someone who worked there? Like, or were you looking at other places and did you apply at other places, or was this just, you were drawn to it somehow, whether through this associate or through what they were doing or whatever?
Well, yeah, you know, I had worked for a bakery. I worked at a bowling alley. I had my own paper route. I mean, I had done lots of different things. I was in landscaping. And in this particular case, I knew that I could control a lot of things. I could control the amount of input I was willing to put in, which is a direct result of the amount of output that you get out of that and the quality of that output.
Yeah.
And then I could control my day, my schedule, my time. I could control how much work I did. I could control how much financial gain I got out of that. So for me, there was a whole lot of, I can build the life that I want for myself with and through this company, because they were very, go forward, and they were a very hustling type company. There was a lot of energy and lots of goal setting. You lived by the goals that you made. And it was just a good environment for me to thrive in because I loved competition. I loved to be outside and all that kind of worked for me.
And when you were off living out of the suitcase for those 4 or 5 years, you were how old when you started that? You were quite young.
I was 18 and a half. Yeah.
18 and a half. So you couldn't even rent a car, or maybe you could in those days at 18 and a half.
I don't know. Yeah, you could back then. Yeah.
So tell me what that was like. I feel like that could be, well, first of all, it could be a really big boost to your ego. Like, hey, these people think that I can do this, but I think it could also be kind of daunting. And, you know, you're probably dealing with lots of people who are older than you. So I'm just kind of thinking like how you approached it and how you felt about it.
Well, the good news there is I knew, and this kind of taught me visualization from the very beginning, Mike. So I knew what I wanted this place to look like because I needed to emulate what we were doing in Cleveland, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So when you begin with the end in mind, it's kind of a cheat sheet, if you will. You know what I mean? It's kind of a guideline. And I heard somebody say one time that I've never built a battleship before, but if I did, I guess the first thing I would do is hire a ship architect. And then you repeat that over and over. I never built a battleship before, but if I did, Next, I'd probably have to find a steel supplier. Okay. And if you keep repeating that over and over and over, after 10 or 15 of these, you're on your way to building the battleship. You know, you're getting an electrical system and a weapon system, and then you're getting a propulsion system and, you know, just common sense. So, yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, it was daunting for back then. I was probably 130 pounds and, you know, 5'8". It was daunting to stand up to a 260-pound, 6'2" union carpenter or a plumber in Chicago. But yeah, I mean, I knew what it looked like. And I said, this is what it needs to look like. So it has to be like this. And it was kind of, in my mind, Mike, it was kind of the best college I could ever get, because it was live and die by the sword of getting it done, getting a result. And again, starting with the end in mind and then just figuring out how to make it happen.
And tell me about your parents, Ken, when you were making these decisions in high school and then out of high school. Were they supportive? Were they unsupportive, indifferent? How were they?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my father was a successful guy. He started to become pretty successful around this same time. He had worked as a grocery store produce manager with five boys under the age of 9, you know what I mean? And making $14,000 a year trying to feed all of us. That wasn't easy to do. But as he grew within his own company, he didn't go to college either. And he always thought that he should have. But it worked out okay, because he got promoted. And then pretty soon he bought into a food brokerage company, and pretty soon he bought his partners out. And then about the same time that I was making this decision, he was starting to do pretty well. So he said, listen, you got two ways to do this. You can go to school and see if that works for you. As long as you have a job that you're thinking about when you come out of there. I mean, you don't just go to college and say, I'm just going to go for 4 years, and then whatever happens, happens. Or he said, this could be pretty good college. I mean, how many times do you get the chance to go open four or five businesses on someone else's dime and get them up and running and then move on to the next one? And those businesses, I'm proud to say, are all still up and running and vibrant today. So it to me, it was about as college can get. My mom was, you know, she was trying to keep five boys happy. And, you know, one of the things that they always said is, we're going to provide for you everything that we can. Obviously, food, clothing, shelter, as much fun as we can do. But if you want something more than that, you're going to have to go out and find a way to pay for it. If you want the best baseball mitt out there, or a new bicycle, or whatever you wanted to do, you had to go get beyond what they were willing to do or could do at the time. Yeah. and go get it yourself. And I think that was part of the training as well.
And you mentioned the visualization skill that you had or developed at a young age. I'm wondering, that seems like something that most people take a little bit longer, outside of athletics, let's say, because some people can visualize what they want to become as athletes at a young age. But in terms of career and thinking into the future like that, it seems like a skill that not too many people at that age have. I mean, I don't know if you see it that way, but I'm curious your take on it and where it came from for you, if you can track it.
Well, I can tell you what I just mentioned was part of it. You know, my father told me when I was 13, I was a pretty good baseball player, and I remember I wanted to buy an aluminum bat. Mm-hmm. And that was like the latest, coolest baseball bat. And he said, well, go find a way to get it. See what you want. Go look, research this thing. And back then there was no computers to go research. So you had to go to the store and look at them, right? Go see it, see what it looks like, and then go make your money and go buy one. So it started there. And, but I have to tell you, I said this earlier this morning on another podcast I was on. So I remember things in English class, like past participles and adjectives and, you know, conjuncted or whatever. I mean, yeah. Conjugated verbs and whatever, right? Why did we learn any of that stuff? I mean, I understand we needed to learn how to add an ED for past tense to make it want or wanted, But to be able to go into all the technical aspects of identifying all those things and why they happen and how they were invented and what why they came to be, I think we could have cut a lot of that stuff out and just taught people other things, like how to be independent, how to think for yourself, how to problem solve, how to be visualization people. Because every one of us does it. I mean, we get out of bed in the morning and we go to put our clothes on. That's a visualization. What do I want myself to look like today? Okay. And then you go downstairs and you create a meal. What do I want that meal to look like? I start with ingredients and I create a meal. Well, why do we leave it at those basics? I think schools could do a lot better at teaching people how to be less dependent on society and more independent by simply teaching them, this is what your life should, could look like. Figure out what that is, plug it in, and then let's build a path for you to at least start thinking about how to go get those things. So I think every one of us has that computer in our brain that creates visualizations. I mean, we do it on a constant basis. We just don't take it the next step as it relates to our future because so many times we live in this reactive mode. It's cold outside. There's snow on the ground. I better put my winter coat on. I'm reacting to that. Okay. And instead of proacting, which is, okay, what's my next year going to look like? 2, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. What do I want these different aspects in my life to look like? What's a vision board for me? How can I build that and look at it twice a day and have the power of the brain take me there?
Yeah.
That's the thing I think that's kind of missing.
And I think I'm glad you went there because you're right. The ability to visualize is probably something that we all have. The ability to execute or move toward the visualization is a different story.
100% correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking about independence, so how do you teach somebody to be independent? And you, how, because you sort of think to yourself, well, is that a taught thing or is that a instinctual thing? Like you're either got, you know, is it a you got it or you don't got it thing or is it something different?
No. So I usually start out by saying this, who knows what your favorite color is? Well, you do. Who knows what your favorite car is? You do. Who knows what you, if you could go create a house, what would it look like? Who knows that but you? Only you do. What's your favorite dog or cat? What color? What would you name it? If you had $100 to give away, what would you do with it? Who can answer that question but you? Nobody can. I mean, what's your favorite sport? What's your favorite hobby? What's your favorite generosity moment, your spiritual moment, your health moment? What would your vacation look like if you could design it the way you wanted? We all know these things for ourselves, and yet we choose to hand that future off to other people and listen to what they have to say. Okay, we choose to put too much stock in what everybody else's opinion is about what our future should look like. I mean, if you truly know those things, then why not get them down on piece of paper? I don't care if you take a poster board and a box of crayons. I actually do that with my people here. Let's draw out what you want your life to look like, the only as you can see it. Because if you said to somebody else, here's my blank sheet and some crayons, can you draw my future for me? They have absolutely no idea how to do that.
Right.
They might have some opinions, but building independence is nothing more than building the confidence in somebody to get them to understand, well, you know what? I guess I am the only one that knows these things. Why am I relying on everybody else for those things to manifest themselves? I can certainly start that process. And oh, by the way, once you have that drawn out, the process of visualization is such, and I believe it, I learned this from Jerick Robbins, Tony Robbins' son. I learned this from him. It's amazing. You know, they say the law of attraction and what your brain sees it achieves and all that kind of stuff. Well, there's a science behind it, Mike, and that is this. The more you stare at something that you want in your life, crystal clear, colorful, concise, the more these your neurotransmitters fire back and forth in your brain to the point where they become one constant thought. Once that happens, your brain actually thinks it already owns that thing. So then it sets your body in motion to go get that thing in things like awareness of opportunities, getting out of bed and going getting it, entrepreneurism, all those kinds of things, initiative, faith, courage, humility, all the characteristics I talk about in Blue Collar Cash. So why not use the power of that and allow your brain to work for you in a way that nobody else, or very few people actually do, because they're just waiting to react to something or for someone else to tell them how to live.
Right. Yeah. As you were going through those things, I was thinking eyes open. That's what I call it, eyes open. So if you want something and your eyes are open to it, the likelihood that you're going to find it is a heck of a lot bigger than you expecting it to be delivered to you somehow.
Well, there was a very interesting study, Mike, by University of Virginia, or actually Virginia Tech, I think it was. And they basically took 100 people and they said, okay, how many of you have crystal clear, precise, concise, vivid, colorful goals running around in your head? Only 20 people of the 80 said that they had that kind of clarity. So they dismissed the 80, they kept the 20, and they said, okay, of the 20, how many of you have those written down in any way, shape, or form? Only 4 people said that they had those things written down. So then they said, okay, of the 4 of you, how many of you have them posted somewhere in your house that you see them more than once a day? 1 person. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they followed those people for 10 years. And that one person earned 9 times more money than the rest of them in the next 10 years. So what's amazing is you don't need a degree for this. You don't need any training for this. You don't need, to go sit in some seminar. I mean, this is something you can go find a quiet space in your house and do this afternoon for free and get good at it. And you know, there goes your life right there.
Yeah. Like you said, with a poster board or crayons, or with a sticky note and a pen.
Yeah.
And you can post those things. Yeah. You know, this whole independence thing has me thinking, like, who knows better than you what you want? Who can answer the questions about you best? Obviously, that's you. So the question is, well, why is it, if that's true, why is it that so many people struggle with actually getting what they want? And so I'm thinking, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this. So it's not enough to know the answers to the questions you're asking yourself. You have to be aware and accept that you are responsible for delivering those things to you as well. Is that something you agree with, or how do you think about that?
It's 100% right. I'll give you this example. A lot of people have well-meaning intentions, okay? Like I researched the word someday. Now, you will never hear me use that word, okay? I challenge anyone out there to find me using that word. And the reason is because when I looked up the definition is at some point in the future, which is not yet determined. So hear me out for a second. You know what? Sure. I'm going to start working out someday. Okay. So what you're telling me is you're going to work out at some point in the future, which is not yet determined. How many people would laugh at you if you said it that way? I'm going to clean out the basement at some point in the future that is not yet determined.
Right.
People would even take you seriously. So people, they have this launching off point, this justification point, this almost I'm satisfying myself by saying, yeah, someday I'm going to do that. Oh, for sure. You know, someday I'm going to do that. And that's where it all begins. If you lose that word from your vocabulary and change it to today, I'm going to clean out the basement, or today, I'm going to put on my calendar that next Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, I'm going to clean out that basement. Now you're doing something completely different. And right. All I can tell you is people actually think that when they use the word someday, they're actually setting a goal, when actually they're unsetting a goal. They're doing the furthest thing from setting a goal.
Yeah.
They're stating a good intention.
And I'll bet they're also fooling themselves into thinking that by saying someday, they're doing more than most.
Absolutely. Right? That's 100% correct. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like the old saying in the bar, free drinks tomorrow. Well, you never get to drink because it's never tomorrow when you're there, right?
Yeah.
So it literally is an awareness of somebody saying, you know what? I have to drop that word from my vocabulary because it's not only not helping me, it's disturbing me.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that's where it all begins, because you're right. It's not enough to know it. It's enough to say, I'm going to act upon it. And then, you know, there's some steps involved there. The first step is congratulations. you're now one of those 1% thinkers at least, because you're actually taking the time to do this. And then, you know, the goals have to be clear. When I said clear, concise, colorful, I meant it, meaning I have to have a brochure of this thing, whatever it is, a clear, colorful brochure that I can see, okay? And then I got to know the price of this thing. I have to chop that price into however many years it's going to take me to get it. I need to get that money into my bank account every Friday that I can't touch, I can't see, I can't access. And then I have to share that goal with somebody else so that they know that I'm accountable to them or yeah. to the world for doing this, which is what we do here. I have 50 goals on the board right outside that door that people have all perfectly orchestrated, mechanically sound, and in play. And they're there for the doing, okay? Not for the observing, for the doing. And that's what separates most people, is that very first step. I don't care, you know, take your goals away from if and turn them into when goals, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't care if it takes you 3 years to get something. That's 156 steps in weeks every Friday.
Yeah.
As long as you're on the path to doing it, you can say, well, I took the hardest step in the world, number one. The other 155 steps, I just have to breathe and I'm going to get there.
Right. And it's funny because so many people that set big goals or don't set big goals don't do it because they're afraid that the first step has to lead to the accomplishment of the goal, as opposed to the first step being just that, the first step. And the second step, and then the third step. And then you may have to take a step back or to the side because you've discovered something along the way that wasn't what you thought it was going to be. But yeah, when you think about A to Z, you think, oh, I'll never get to Z, so I might as well not even get to B.
I had a gal in my office. She was walking down the hallway. This is the funniest thing. She's walking down the hallway. She's in my book, by the way. I talk about her in Blue Collar Cash. So she says, wow, that's really nice that you do that goal board for your people. You know, someday I'm going to get on that board. And I said, and the person I was standing there talking to looked at her and said, you did not just say that. So she said, well, I have to think about what I want to do. And I said, okay, come in tomorrow and I want to know what you're going to do. She came in the next day. She said, I've always felt bad that I never paid my father off for a car that he bought me, $2,500 car. And someday I want to pay him back. And I said, okay, well, let's start that right now. I think that's $48 a week for a year. And she goes, I said, can you do that? And she said, I will find a way to do that. Well, we put it up on the board, January 1, Kiara, pay my dad back $2,500, 48 bucks a week for 52 weeks, signed, dated. She signed it. I signed it. Completion date, you know, New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And, a month goes by and she goes, wow, I only have 11 more months. That was like a breeze. It was four Fridays, you know, and then 2 months and then a quarter and then half year. And people are high-fiving her because she's halfway through. And then she comes to me, she goes, that was the fastest year of my life. I don't even remember putting the goal up on the board. It was like yesterday. And $2,500 later, she paid her dad off. He flipped out because he didn't think he was ever getting this money back.
Hmm.
And then now she's got the confidence to, she's bought and paid for a wedding. She's bought her first and her second house already. She has a new car and she's got two beautiful kids. And she's into this goal-oriented, like goal-crushing type of mentality. And I didn't do anything. All I did was turn on a light switch and she did the rest of it. So it's so powerful, and yet people don't know how to do it. And it just kills me. This is why I'm trying to spread the word.
Yeah. And I think, I'd be curious, it sounds like you probably think this too, but I think that helping someone become a goal setter and goal achiever is one of the most powerful things you can do to help another human being. Like what you just described with her, you basically pushed her to create a habit that she then liked the outcome of that habit, and then she perpetuated that habit, and that habit happens to be setting and achieving goals, which she otherwise may not have ever done because she didn't have that push or that encouragement or whatever. What do you think?
Well, that's exactly right. And the other thing is, let's take that a step further. Like, I'm a business, yep. Okay, I have 200 people here now, right? So if I can get as many of those as possible, if I can get 100 of them to be rowing in that same direction like Kiera did, I always tell them I can't get what I want for myself, nor can my company get what it wants or needs until all of you get what you need first.
Yeah.
And it's true because businesses are linear creatures. You got your input, you've got the work, you've got the output. The owner is always at the output side. Hopefully there's profit left and then he or she makes some money.
Right.
So the way I see this is I need you to work for yourself first and work for me or this company second. Because if all of you are out there winning, guess what's going to happen? This company is going to grow crazy and it works. You just have to kind of have to absolve yourself of the fact that I got to let go of this thing called ego. Me boss, you employee, I got to let go of that. I have to allow the entrepreneurial spirit to grow within the company, allow these people to win for themselves first and me second, or the company second. Because when that happens, that concerted effort will take you and your company to levels you couldn't even imagine. And it's happened here. And that's kind of a business point of doing this. I love helping people. I would help Kiera's if I just saw him on the street doing this.
Mm-hmm.
But as a group of individuals working here as a company, my job now is to walk around and just high five people and say, great job on hitting that goal. Great job setting that goal up. Great job. You're almost there. It's the best thing in the world.
So do you mind if I dig in a little bit more on goals? Because this is, to me, very fascinating, your take on this. So
yeah.
First off, you said you've got these 50 goals outside your office. Most people, most organizations can't handle more than a couple of goals a quarter, let's say. That's conventional wisdom, right? That they can't handle that. And that someone else's goals can't be your goals. In other words, you can't inflict a goal on somebody. There has to be they have to buy into whatever that goal is. Now, so two questions. One, do you agree with that? And if not, either way, tell me why. And two, how do you actually implement the 50? How does it work?
Okay, so the word buy-in is interesting because if I asked you to draw the word buy-in, you'd have to say, how am I going to draw that? Well, what that really means to me is they realize that that goal is going to help not only themselves, but the company. And how is it going to help them? It's going to help to make their life better. Well, how's it going to help to make their life better? Well, it's going to help them to gain the things they want for themselves that they see for their future. That's buy-in. Okay. Now, the 50 goals I'm talking about on the board are all people's individual goals. Kiera wants to pay off her dad. He wants to pay down his visa. This guy wants to learn Spanish. This guy wants to go to England to visit his aunt. Or she wants to go. So there's all these individual goals going on.
Got it.
But they all know that the best way to get all those goals is to buy in, if you will, to the company's overarching goal. And so we're both winning at the same time. Everybody's winning at the same time. And so they will win as individuals. And then if the company hits these higher plateaus, they'll also share in part of that higher plateau. So they win twice.
Hmm.
They get their individual thing and then they get a nice bonus for hitting the overarching goal.
Okay.
So now you've got the power of all these visionaries running around your hallways. It's just ridiculous how strong that is and how much energy there is in making those things happen.
Yeah, I like how you tie that together too, because someone that's doing something for themselves that also benefits the larger or sees the connection to the benefit to the larger organization, like there's a lot of...
It's almost cohesive at that point.
Yeah. And it's kind of like you get used to the reward too. So it's kind of like, oh, confidence, I like the reward, I'm going to do more of that so I can get more of that.
Right.
Yeah. I like that.
They do call it an addiction, and you know, it's the best kind of addiction, because you know, the fun part about getting goals that are 1, 2, 3, 5 years long, Mike, is the fact that there is nothing better and more fun in this world than anticipation of something.
Yeah.
And especially of something good. You know, I use the analogy all the time. You know, here I am in January, there's snow everywhere, it's freezing outside. And I know that I'm going to go to Florida in March or April, right? And I think about that. So I'm planning a plane ticket. Okay, I'm going to go to the beach. I'm going to get my towel, my sandals. I'm going to get my Copper Tone suntan lotion that smells so good. I'm going to get, you know, my drink, my music, my umbrella, whatever, my bathing suit. I can feel, touch, and almost taste all those things.
Right.
Well, that's an anticipatory reaction. I mean, you're anticipating the coolness of your vacation. And I think all deep down, we all know how to do that, right? So all I'm asking everyone to do is to apply that same powerful formula of anticipation to all the other things in their life and allow those things to come in.
Okay. And one more thing on goal, or at least one more thing. How do you think about, like, I've heard people say that goals have to be, you know, like the SMART thing, right? They have to be specific. They have to be measurable. They have to have a time set to them, that kind of thing. But one of that SMART thing is they have to be achievable. In other words, they have to be realistic. I'm kind of on the fence about that sometimes. I think it depends on the person as to whether the goal appears to be realistic or not. Because I think there are some people who are sort of stymied by goals that they don't believe to be realistic. But then there are other people who are like totally energized about a goal that everybody else thinks is not achievable. How do you come down on that, Ken?
So I'll tell you about one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made when it comes to goal setting. As a corporation, we sat around the table and I had probably 10 or so people, all entrepreneurial thinkers around me. And I said, you know, this is our current level of revenue. I want to get to the next level of revenue. I don't know what that is, but I'm thinking of a number in my head that I'd like to get to. And if we do, then I'm going to share in a piece of all of that increase with all of you. Okay. So once you know it, we went around the room, we gave each other a little piece of paper and everyone had a pen and they wrote down their revenue number. Wouldn't you know, Mike, that every one of their revenue numbers was at least $1 million higher than mine?
Okay.
So be careful that you are not your own ceiling is what, yes. is the story of the lesson there. Now, if they have a hand in designing the goal, they'll own it, right? Mm-hmm. If you just, like you said, if you just cast upon them a goal that they don't believe in, that doesn't do anybody any good.
Right.
But moreover, if you can connect that goal that they have designed as an overarching goal for the company, and they're individually connected to it in some individual way through the goal board and what they have and they want to do, then now you're onto something there. Now you've got the power of all that collective energy to make this thing happen for yourself. The problem comes in is when people, they don't put enough effort into their goal. And they don't really believe it, even if they set it up. You know, like I have a guy that says, oh, I want to be taller. Okay, well, that's not really a goal. I mean, you get it. I understand you want to be taller, but that's not really a goal.
That's a wish.
It's a wish, a dream,
a dream or a hope. Right.
And so it's all about the clarity of the path to getting this goal. It's all about setting it out far enough that they know they can do it for sure, and then connecting it to this bigger group, and then get out of the way, man, because it's going to be fun.
How do you feel about starting a goal with the words, I will, or we will, if it's an individual or collective goal? Do you think there's power to adding those two words to the front, or do you think it doesn't matter?
If the path is clear enough, it doesn't. I mean, a lot of times you'll have them say, I am going to London in a year and mm-hmm. I'm going to do it by this. So you'll see that they'll write it on the board. I am.
Okay.
Which is kind of like, I will, or we will. But as long as the steps are there, I don't care what the precursor is. It's the 52 weeks times $48 or whatever that mechanism is. That has to be clear, because once that's clear, the fact that you say, I will, it doesn't matter, because when you're saying I will do something, you're trying to become resolute to it, right?
Committed.
You can say I will all you want, but if the path isn't there, is that going to stick?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. That's fair enough. So blue collar cash, you started with the business with six people, you said, after 4 or 5 years with this other company. So that's like a giant step to now you're the book, now you're the you got everything on the line yourself, six people. Now you have 200 plus. And your book, Blue Collar Cash, is a lot about, hey, you don't necessarily need a college degree in order to be successful. You are an obvious example of that. I'm curious for you, before we dig into the book, for you, there's two things. One is, how have you continued your education as an entrepreneur, business owner, leader? Maybe outside of, I'm assuming that you continue to educate yourself, right? Because you don't go from running a company with six people to 200 and not evolve as a leader, entrepreneur, business owner. And then second, you mentioned overarching goal a couple of times, and I wondered, what is your overarching goal? So sorry to combine two big questions together, but we can just take them one at a
Well,
time.
the first one is I continue to look at what the industry is doing and make myself aware of the opportunities that lie within the industry. And I do know one thing. I know my lane. I know the construction lane. So I'm gonna become aware of what's going on out there. We've added products and services to our business over time. Those products and services bring in additional revenue to the main contract that we used to start with. And so yeah, you just make yourself aware of, how are we going to get to that next revenue level? Are we going to sell more? Are we going to spend less? Are we going to do both? What services can we add to our offering, which will bring that additional revenues in? And so yeah, you make yourself aware within the industry of the things that are out there, and you add those things to it. But I can also say that having these goals get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and having these people that surround me, working entrepreneurially, their goals get bigger and bigger. That to me is the overarching part, because if I it, my goal is to provide a vehicle that everybody here can drive to make their life exactly how they want it to be. Okay. I built this company. There's four walls, there's a lot of moving parts, and everybody in here has a path for them, for their betterment, that they can follow. And all I do is turn the car on every morning, and then they just drive it around. So it literally is, it's like an honor for me to walk the hallways and literally high five people that are trying to make things happen for themselves. It's the most fun you can be as a boss, I guess.
Is that the is by the way, that was a beautiful thing that you said there. Is that the most consequential, impactful thing that you can be doing now at this stage is supporting other people in the
Yeah.
pursuit of their and your goals, or is there something more?
Well, I can tell you this. Right before I got on with you, I was literally chopping up cucumbers, and we were baking cookies and making chicken parmesan, and we were making salad and stuff for the local Ronald McDonald House. And I took six or seven people with me. You go there, you make this huge meal, cook for 35 people, you box it all up, and then you disappear. And the parents that are staying there that have kids across the street in the hospital that are suffering, they come home at night and they eat this meal, and it's a home cooked meal. And they don't know who did it. We're not looking for credit. We just go do it. And so giving back to me is just, it's a ginormous bad word, but it's a ginormous opportunity. Now, I've been doing it for a very long time. We don't just write checks and put them in the mail and call ourselves cool, you know? We use time, talent, and treasure. So gathering the people around us and going and doing all these different projects, we support probably 10 different charities a year. And most of them, we actually get involved in doing something. So I would tell you this, it's incumbent upon all of us to share the gifts that we have, and to whom much is given, much is expected. You've read that before. So to teach other people how to give back in ways that they might not either learn how or know how or could afford to on their own is ridiculously cool. It is so much fun. And not only do they enjoy it, but then they come, they go home and they tell their families what they did, and they feel proud for what they've done. And they feel like, wow, this company is a really cool place to be.
And you to whom much is given, much is expected. I believe that's Tony Robbins says that all the time. You had mentioned his son. Tony Robbins wrote a blurb for your book. How are you acquainted with Tony Robbins and his son and his organization, and what have you learned from one another?
So Tony Robbins, he started a company called Fountain Life.
Yeah.
Fountain Life is kind of a go forward. If you remember us talking about reactions to proactions, Fountain Life is to proactive healthcare as normal hospitals are to reactive healthcare. Okay.
Yes.
So I'm a member of that club, and I knew that he had started it. So I just started emailing him back and forth, and we talked about a little bit about, you know, what our thinking was and what my project was, because I was more specific to blue collar than what he does. And he loved it, and he just said, "Hey, I'm happy to write this for you." And yeah, that was really, really cool. So
okay,
yeah, he's obviously a very successful guy. His son's really cool too. So yeah, it's fun.
Okay, yeah, he started that with Peter Diamandis and some other.
Exactly.
People.
Yeah. George Shapiro, Peter Diamandis, and there's a couple other gentlemen, Bill Kapp and a couple other gentlemen, but very great people, very great forward thinkers. These guys are going to live to 120, and I believe them.
Yeah.
And hopefully I'm going to join them. So,
yeah. Well, find the disease before the disease finds you, and then you can do something about it. Hopefully.
100%
right?
Correct. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. So the book itself, why now? Why this book? Why now? I mean, you didn't have to do this, right? You got all this stuff going on, but you did it. Why? How come?
So I'm a dad. I have a 26, soon to be 27 year old daughter who just had her first grandchild, and being
congratulations.
A parent, thank you. Being a parent is by far the best thing you can do with your life. There's no doubt. I would say this: when she was 12, she got a really serious illness, and you remember reading about it in the book. And I would just remember, you know, this was 5 years of horror for her mother and I, and for her, obviously. And I just remember sitting in office rooms and doctor's offices and oncology offices and ultrasound offices and all these things. And I just remember thinking, what can I tell Nicole that is the meaning of life? You know, what can I get? What can I impart upon her that she should be chasing if she's going to chase anything at all? And the words comfort, peace, and freedom just kept coming back to me, Mike. I couldn't get them out of my head. I mean, for 6 months, I could not lose these three words. And I always saw them in like this triangle of inter-support where they're connected to each other and they support each other. So I started writing about, well, maybe that's what it is. Maybe we should be chasing comfort, peace, and freedom as only we know it. Okay. I'm not going to tell you that you need to be a rap star. You need to have 15 cars and a McMansion and a mega yacht and airplanes and all this stuff to be cool, to have a great life. I'm not going to tell you that, because everyone has their own level, their own nirvana, their own vision of what they want their life to look like. If I could live like that, that would be really, really cool. It goes back to that vision board. So I said, I'm going to write about that. And so I started writing a letter to her, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 or 11,000 words later, maybe 12, you know, my wife's looking at me and she says, you know, you do all this coaching at work. And before I get any further, I've never went to college. I've never studied coaching. I don't have any letters after my name. I have no therapy. I have none of that. All I do is help people to try to see 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years, six, whatever, ahead of them and what they could look like. And I've done that so much that she said, you know, you might want to get what you do beyond the four walls of your company. I think you have a book here. And to her credit, I never set out to write a book.
Started as a letter to your daughter.
Started as a letter to my daughter. And then pretty soon I started writing about all my friends that overcame unbelievable obstacles to be successful blue collar entrepreneurs. And 80,000 words later, and a bunch of pens and legal pads full of words. And I started literally Googling editors in New York and found a buddy of mine, Kevin Anderson. He had a whole bunch of like ghostwriters and editors that worked for him. And they took what I did and cleaned it up. And then they found me an agent, and then they found me a social media group, and I don't know any of this stuff. Okay, I'm just a guy that digs ditches, right?
Mm-hmm.
So pretty soon I had 6 or 7 publishing houses bidding on this thing, and you know, boom, there it went. It became pretty popular. It unfortunately I released it during COVID, which wasn't the best, but they re-released it a year later and became a bestseller, and I'm just wholly blessed and grateful for it.
What's happened in your life since you've released the book and since it's become a bestseller that you weren't anticipating?
That is a really great question. First off, everyone wants you to write another one, mm-hmm. right? And I've actually started doing that, which is pretty cool. But I think what was neat was I didn't expect that there would be 3 different readers. So the first reader is someone 15 to 25 who just wants to see what their life is going to be, and they're starting out and they want to try to figure that out. The second reader was someone, and I've had a lot of these, Mike, where they said, I went to college. I'm now selling medical supplies out of a cubicle on the 15th floor of some building. I can't stand it. I was a plumber through college, a plumber's assistant. I loved being with people, and I quit my job. I went back to being a plumber. I've never been so happy. So I've had some like retro people come back into this and do great things. And then the third reader was corporations who decided to make this a book club for their members. They would buy, you know, 50 or whatever books, and they would sit down and they would say, hey, we're going to read a chapter a week, and every 2 or 3 weeks we're going to meet on it. We're going to build this entrepreneurial glue. We're going to glue these people together and come up with an overarching goal, and we're going to go get it. And the fact that I had 3 diverse readers was pretty neat.
And you talk about, you know, this not only the opportunities for blue collar, but the crisis, the crisis in the American workforce. So for people who don't have an understanding of what you mean by that, what is the crisis?
So it's a perfect storm of 3 things. So when I was in high school, I could walk down the hallways and I could see a guy changing a transmission on a Mustang to my left, to the right. I could see a guy in another room milling a table leg for a dining room table. I could go down the hallway and watch an electrician work. I could go over here and watch someone cutting hair or doing nails. I could go over there and watch somebody baking something. It was shop class, and everybody had it in high school. That's where millions of kids learned how cool it was to be a carpenter, a plumber, electrician, a welder, whatever, hairdresser, whatever. Well, they took those classes out of high school and they replaced them with computers, which I guess we needed to all learn computers. But why did we have to kick the other one out? Why couldn't we have had both, right? So that's problem number one. The second part of this perfect storm is the fact that when I was younger, we would grab lumber and a hammer and some nails, and we'd go build a tree fort, right? Climb a tree and build a tree fort. And you'd pass and you'd fail. You'd do good things and bad. You'd fix things. You'd repair things. And we dug, you know, we played in ponds and creeks, and we rode our bikes and made jumps, and we did, you know, fixed our own stuff and whatever, right? Well, now you got kids sitting around on these screens playing Minecraft, which I don't mind Minecraft. That's fine. But that's not the same thing as going out and doing it with your own 2 hands, right? So you got these kids that don't know how to use a rake, a shovel, a broom. They don't know how to use any of these basic tools with which they're going to need for the rest of their life if they ever want to plant a flower, or a tree, or a bush, or landscape their front yard. So it's sad that that's the second part of the problem. The third part of the problem is colleges are really good at shaming parents into thinking, if you don't send your kid my way, he or she will be a loser for the rest of their life.
Right.
They're really good at doing that. And before I go any further, I'm not an anti-college guy. If you're going to operate on my shoulders so I can get back out on the golf course, I want you to know everything there is to know about a knife before you come at me with it. Okay, I get it. But absent that, teacher, architect, engineer, finance guy, I mean, things where you need that knowledge. And there's a specific job waiting for you when you're done. Just going to college because someone shamed you into sending your kid there and spending 80 grand, and then they come out and now they have 80 grand in debt and they can't even get a job to pay for it.
Right.
Or the job they get is paying a lot less than they thought it would. That's a mistake. And colleges are really, really, there's a book out there that said college is a scam. I'm not going to go as far as to say it's a scam, but it is ill-fit for 50% of the population. And the reason I say that is because if you look today, 177 million people are considered full employment in the U.S. 77 million of those people do something with their hands to this very day, to this moment. So why are we trying to shame people into thinking 100% of our kids need a college degree? It's that part is a scam.
Yeah.
So, you know, take it for what it is. And I wrote an open letter to parents. It's on my website. And I said, guys, and ladies and gentlemen, I get it. You birthed your child. You coddled them, you clothed them, you fed them, you sheltered them. You're trying to teach them basic things that you know. And you think that the only way you can walk this earth is to say, my kid has a college degree, and therefore I'm a successful parent. That is just patently untrue. It's never been true. It isn't true now, and it's certainly going to be less true as we move forward. So all this builds up, Mike, to the fact that nobody's going into these trades. And because of that, for every 10 electricians that retire, only 4 or 5 are coming online.
Right.
What does that tell you? Supply and demand 101, econ class, 9th grade, where supply is low and demand is high, that's where the money goes. So if you're willing to not be shamed, if you're willing to buck the system, get into a trade, you're going to make a fortune, because no one's willing to do it.
Yeah, two things. What you said, nobody knows how to do, most people don't know how to do anything anymore. Two, that's going to accelerate because AI is going to do more and more and more and more for you. Three, I guess four things. Three, AI is never going to dig a ditch. AI is never going to...
Right. Plant a tree.
Never going to wire a house, never going to do any of those things. And four, blue collar is going to rule the world when it comes to wage acceleration and entrepreneurship, in my opinion.
I heard a stat the other day on Joe Rogan's podcast, and the guy was saying, if you started an electrician business today in Austin, Texas, it will most certainly be worth $5 million in 5 years.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah. Think about that. Think about that. Really. People, think about that.
Well, and this is one of the things I tell parents. I said, you know, construction jobs right now just cross $30 an hour, okay? Pretty much entry level, right? So that's $75,000 a year times 4 years is $300,000, right? You could pay $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 a year for college. And 4 years later, that's $200,000 or $300,000 on the negative side of your asset base because you borrowed that money. That's a $500,000 swing.
Yeah, huge.
So I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying at least think about that before you just blindly follow the crowd and dump your kid into a life's worth of debt. That studies show only 30% of college degrees are ever used. Ever.
Ever. Yeah.
So it's really interesting how that's come to light.
So there's three things I want to end on as we're bumping up against our time here. First of all, thank you for writing the book.
You're welcome.
Thank you for including Appendix 2, which is Successful People Without College Degrees. That is an eye-opening appendix.
Yes, it is.
So that is, I mean, Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Carnegie, James Cameron, Henry Ford, David Geffen. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of people, Michael Dell. I mean, well, Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, you can include all these people. So thank you for including that in the book. This is one of my most memorable lines from the book. I underlined it when I read it. It's in the very beginning, Ken, and it says, remember these two things as you read along. One, I believe everyone has the ability to be the person they were meant to be. That is extremely powerful. And two, no one is in charge of your success, your comfort, peace, and freedom, except you. Let's dig in and get started. That is a great way to start a book. So I thank you for putting those two in there. I underline that and I'm like, damn, that is so good. Comfort, peace, and freedom. I love that. Comfort, peace, and freedom. That's so thank you for that. And then the last thing, you said you don't have any initials behind your name, next to your name. So I'm going to add some. I just thought I'm going to add PDS. Pretty darn successful, or you can put smart, one or the other. But I think both of those apply to you. And I thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. Thank you for writing your book, Blue Collar Cash. Pick it up, people. You are going to love it. It's a Wall Street Journal bestseller. I'm sure it's an Amazon bestseller in multiple categories as well. What do you want people to do, Ken? Do you want them to connect with you on your website? Where do you want to direct people to want to learn more about you?
Well, a couple things. So I want to make sure that the book that I wrote, I heard this the other day and I thought it was funny. So I stole it from the gentleman. I want to make sure that my book is a self-help book, not a shelf help book. And meaning so many times people read books and I ask them, what'd you get out of that book? It was a good book. How did it change your life? I don't know, but I mean, it was a good book. So I built a course around it. It's 8 sessions, 45 minutes a session. It's all about visualization, teaching your mind to think differently. When you take this course, you can take it in a weekend or 8 days or 8 weeks, whatever you want to do. I'm forcing you to create a vision board for yourself.
Okay.
And I teach you how to do it along the way and how to clear your mind so you can clearly do this. You will think differently about your life that afternoon, not in a month or a year or whatever. You will think differently about who you are the minute you start this course, because I get right out of the chute saying, what's it look like, man? How do you want this to look? And this is how you begin the process. So, you know, the book's $25. You get a free copy of the book with the course. It's like I said, it's $179. I typically donate most of my revenue from the course to charities anyway, because the rest of my life is pretty good and I really didn't do this to make money. So you can find all that stuff at kenrusk.com. You can also follow me at Ken Rusk Official on all the social media stuff. I have a team that helps me do that, because I can do the talking, but I can't do the engineering part. So I get young people to help me do that. And it's so much fun. So yeah, you can follow me in both those places. And then I also started a foundation where I can give this material away free to Gold Star families or you know, people that are in the military that are out of the reach of the government services at this point, but still want some clarity, because we got to trim some of that military suicide thing that's going on. We got to really knock that down. And that's part of my mission to do that as well.
Okay. Awesome. Is there anything else that I should have asked you, Ken, that I didn't and you would like to leave us with?
Not at all. Just remember this, you and only you. Okay. I need everyone to write down you and only you. And then you can finish the sentence with whatever you want. You and only you knows your favorite color. You and only you knows your favorite house. You and only you knows your favorite way to live. You and only you know what your nirvana is. You and only you knows what makes you comfortable, peaceful, and free. And so trust yourself. Write those words down and trust yourself. Start living your life today.
You and only you. You heard it. Ken, thank you very much for writing the book. Thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing your story with us.
You're welcome, Mike. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the show. And before you go, I just have 3 requests for you. One, if you like what I'm doing, please consider subscribing or following the podcast on whatever podcast platform you prefer. If you're really into it, leave me a review, write something nice about me, give me 5 stars or whatever you feel is most appropriate. Number 2, I've got a book. It's called Ownership, How Getting Selfish Got Me Unstuck. It's an Amazon bestseller. And I'd love for you to read it or listen to it on Audible or wherever else, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. You can get it everywhere. If you're looking for inspiration that will help you unlock your greatness and potential, order or download it today so that you can have your very own copy. And if you get it, please let me know what you think. Number 3, my newsletter. I do a newsletter every Thursday and I talk about things that are interesting to me and or I give more information about the podcast and the podcast guests that I've had and the experiences that I've had with them. You can sign up for the podcast today at my website, which is my name, mikemalatesta.com. You do that right now, put in your email address, and you'll get the very next issue. The newsletter is short, thoughtful, and designed to inspire, activate, and maximize the greatness in you.